Strafford is the kind of person that would simply encounter a child and for no reason at all snuff that child's life out.
Strafford was like a babe in arms. We're talking about somebody with an IQ of 9 or 10 years of age.
There he was, 50 odd years in prison, and basically waiting to die.
Britain's longest serving prisoner died in 2007. John Strafford had been incarcerated for 55 years and 3 months. He was the notorious child killer who escaped from Broadmoor. He is remembered for one of the most controversial trials in English criminal history. I'm Fred Dinage, and I'm investigating some of Britain's most infamous murderers. I want to know the true stories behind their horrific crimes. I want to find out what motivates someone to kill, and to discover how they think they'll get away with it. During the 1950s, John Strafford was sent to Broadmoor for the brutal murder of 2 young girls. Only 6 months later, the 22-year-old escaped from the high-security hospital and killed another child. Caught again, Strafford would eventually become the longest-serving prisoner in British history. What turned this man with an IQ of just 58 into a murderer? John Strafford was born in 1930 at the Borden Army Camp in Hampshire, but spent his early years stationed with his family in India. In 1938, the family returned to England and settled in Bath. Before long, the young Strafford's behaviour started to deteriorate. Strafford's case has intrigued criminologists, historians and authors. Crime writer David Kidd Hewitt has made an in-depth study of the child killer.
When he came back from India, one or two problems started, didn't they? What happened?
Yes, there were some problems of pilfering, petty things, playing truant from school. He wasn't really interested in school. There was also the episode where he stole a purse, and that was reported to the police.
The juvenile court placed the 8-year-old Strafford on probation for 2 years. He did not engage well with his probation officer, who described him as a real problem child.
He was further assessed as to his mental capabilities, as to whether he should have a special education rather than just be having probation supervision. And under the legislation at that time, people were divided into 4 groups under this mental deficiency legislation: imbeciles, idiots, moral defectives, and feeble-minded.
Strafford was certified as a mental defective under the Mental Deficiency Act. He struggled at school and had no understanding of right or wrong. Encephalitis, an acute inflammation of the brain, was later revealed as the cause for Strafford's stunted mental growth.
More often than not, it seems, a person's IQ can have deadly consequences. Professor David Wilson, a leading criminologist, has studied the impact of a killer's mental abilities.
Now, what we mean by mental defective at that time, which was 1940, they just simply means he has an arrested or incomplete development of the mind. In terms of his IQ in 1940, he has an IQ of 58. So we've got a 10-year-old boy with an IQ of 58, which is well below average, and he has the reasoning abilities of a 6-year-old. In the 1940s, IQ was used to measure a child's learning ability. 17% of all children tested were classed as having special educative needs. Strafford's IQ was well below the average of 100. at these times, you have to remember we're at war. There's the growing role of the state in trying to manage people labeled in the way that Strafford had been labeled. And so they take Strafford into an institution, which is known as the colony, where they're going to try and work with him to improve his moral reasoning, to improve his abilities to interrelate through learning how to read or write.
His school report from sort of 9 to 12 was that he was affectionate. He seemed to be quite amenable. Not somebody who was violent in any way or aggressive. The negative part that was starting to feed through was that, in fact, he liked his own company. And he did resent authority and being scolded. He would actually, if he was told off that he'd broken a rule, he would sulk and be very, very down about this kind of interference in what he wanted to do.
Strafford spent 6 years in residential schools known as colonies. They specifically catered for delinquent juveniles and mental defectives. Focusing on lessons in menial labour, the pupils were expected to find work at 16 and eventually be rehabilitated back into society. In 1946, Strafford was released.
When he got back to Bath, he did find himself a job as a machinist in a clothing factory. And in fact, this looked to though it could last, because I think he was there around about 10 months and doing quite well. So there was some hope that maybe he's settling down and he could work in some capacity.
In 1947, just 1 year after being released back into society, the quiet lad began to change.
Stealing was one activity that he was starting to engage in at 16 and 17. But there was also a police report that he had technically, I suppose, assaulted a young girl by putting his hand over her mouth and had said to her, "What would you do if I killed you? I have done it before."
I think if we were to encounter him at that stage in his development, we'd realize pretty quickly that he was not like us. He didn't see the consequences of his behavior. He couldn't make this moral leap between what he would do to what might happen and how thereafter he was going to be judged. And I think we would have picked that up pretty quickly.
Strafford's abusive behavior had him placed back in another rehabilitation colony. Over 3 years later, in 1951, Strafford gained employment and left the establishment.
The thing that he resented, that when he reached 21, he was required to be tested again for mental abilities. And that certification would last another 5 years. He wanted to break that cord, that lead, that string, whatever, to that connection with authority. And he was very, very upset about the fact he had to go for testing.
On the 10th of July 1951, Strafford was again examined by Dr. Astley Weston and certified again a mental defective. He was 21 and now an adult. That day triggered a sequence of events that eventually led to Strafford's downfall and to the deaths of three innocent young girls.
He would read an article in a newspaper that would change his life forever.
That very day, there was a little girl murdered as well, which then made all the papers. Christine Butcher, age 7, was murdered, strangled, in fact. This was in Windsor, this took place. And she was sexually assaulted. And it was a horrific, horrific murder, which the press really went to town on. Some people have assumed, this is retrospectively, that perhaps Strafford knew about this, read about this, and was intrigued by it.
What interests Strafford about the murder of that little girl is that the police could not work out who the culprit was. And I think that plants a seed in Strafford's mind about how to get back at the police, how to focus his resentment at the controls that are being placed on him by the state, what he might be able to do to rebel against that.
Cops and robbers, of course, have always been arch enemies, but why did John Strafford hate the police so much? Bobby Cummins, an ex-offender, runs a charity called Unlock, which helps others stay on the straight and narrow. And he understands more than most the difficult relationship which can exist between the police and the criminal. Why did John Straffan hate the police so much?
I think John hated every form of authority. He saw it as oppressive. What you're dealing with, Fred, is it's like a child in a man's body. So if you didn't agree with him, you were the enemy. He'd been let down by the system very badly. The system didn't protect him. What the system did was done the brutalisation on him. So when he see police officers, all those bad things that happened in the past would come to his head, and he would associate that uniform as an abuser.
The detectives had failed in their search for Christine Butcher's killer. This sparked an idea for Straffan of how to cause his enemy, the police, the maximum amount of trouble. On the 15th of July 1951, Straffan set out for his regular Sunday afternoon trip to the cinema. En route, he stumbled across six-year-old Brenda Goddard collecting flowers.
He was going to the cinema in Bath, the Beau Nash Cinema, to see a film called Shockproof. And the route he took to the cinema happened to pass an area where Brenda happened to be walking. At that particular moment, Straffan is passing by and engages her in conversation, as far as we can tell.
Straffan says to her, "Let me show you where you can get better, nicer flowers to pick." And crucially, those nicer flowers were some way away in another field, which would involve Straffan having to lift Brenda Goddard over a wall.
As Straffan lifted the young girl, she fell and hit her head on a stone, rendering her unconscious. He then spontaneously strangled her until she was dead.
Straffan continued on his journey to the cinema and spent the afternoon eating sweets, watching a film, completely oblivious and detached from the brutal murder he had just committed. He'd strangled Brenda Goddard and left her body lying in this field. His only apparent motive, simply to anger the police he hated so much. I'm Fred Dynage, and I'm investigating the case of John Straffan, a child killer who viewed his three gruesome murders as an act of revenge against the police.
On Sunday, July the 15th, 1951, Straffan had tricked six-year-old Brenda Goddard into following him, strangling the child and leaving her body lying in a field.
Straffan has no concept of his behaviour and the consequences of his behaviour. He has no sense of his personal responsibility. So after he's murdered Brenda Goddard, he simply abandons the body, no attempt to hide it, to conceal it. In fact, he goes to the cinema, so he's not anxious, he's not showing any anxiety about the fact he's committed a murder. He simply goes to the cinema.
Brenda's guardian, Doris Pullen, quickly noticed her missing and a search began. 5 hours later, her body was found.
Brenda's foster mother was looking for her round about sort of 2:20, 2:25, because she'd wandered from the garden very frantically, sort of, where's she gone, where's she gone? And Straffan did mention in his later statements to the police that he did see this woman. She looked at him. He said, "I took no notice." And she did report to the police that, in fact, she had seen a man in a blue suit.
Straffan didn't realise the significance of being seen by Mrs. Pullen. Why would the police be suspicious of a man seen walking in the area?
We're dealing with somebody who has a very low IQ, misunderstands the concept of there being an eyewitness. Because this murder has taken behind a wall, Straffan, in his reasoning, thinks that there has been no eyewitness because nobody has seen him commit the murder.
Straffan believed he'd got away with murder. The police questioned the local suspects, but still had no solid evidence as to the killer. Investigative journalist Bob Woffenden's passion for justice drew him to John Straffan's controversial case.
What happened after the Brenda Goddard murder? It was clearly known that he'd been in the vicinity, and so they came and questioned him twice about the murder, but they had no evidence, so they didn't arrest him, but they merely questioned him. He was working at that stage for a market gardener, and in the wake of those interviews, he was sacked. I think the market gardener felt he didn't want that sort of person on his staff anyway, even though he'd apparently not been arrested or charged. And so the fact that he'd lost his job merely increased Strafford's antipathy towards the police.
Sacked from his job, Strafford's hatred for the police increased. In his eyes, it was time for more deadly vengeance. On the 8th of August 1951, Strafford deliberately targeted 9-year-old Cicely Batson.
Again, of course, we only have Strafford's version of events, where he claims, again, going to the cinema, going to the afternoon showing of a Tarzan film. And he says that this young girl, Cicely Batstone, came and sat next to him. Well, we don't know, but I should imagine he went and sat next to her in the cinema, but they met in the cinema. She liked talking about Tarzan films, and he really found her somebody that he could chat to.
9-year-old Cicely Batstone sat and watched the film with the tall, blonde stranger, unaware of his intentions.
I think that's why it's really important to remember that there would be different attitudes in the 1950s to what childhood was, to the freedoms that we gave to children. You know, when you and I were growing up and it was the summer holidays, we'd be allowed, you know, our parents effectively opened the front door and said, come back when you're hungry. It was a time when people looked out for each other, they'd leave their front doors open, and childhood had many greater freedoms than childhood does now.
Strafford had gained Cicely's trust. He persuaded her to go across town by bus to the Scala Cinema to watch another film.
When they came out together, it was around about 8 o'clock, still light. And we just don't know whether he took her willingly or he had threatened her. We have no idea, but she went with him for a small walk through a housing estate. He gets as far as this area called the Tumps, which is a sort of a gated area. You go through to this field. And he takes her into this field and is apparently playing with her.
In the field, a courting couple passed so near they could see Strafford playing with a laughing little girl. When he spotted them, he stood and watched them until they walked away. Strafford then strangled the 9-year-old, leaving her body lying in the Tumps.
She would have been trusting, she would have been innocent. Remember, children are historically targets of murderers, and clearly in that sense, the boundaries of childhood allow Strafford to behave in the way that he wanted to behave.
In his statement to the police, Strafford described leaving her asleep on the grass, lying on her side next to the hedge. Once again, Strafford had detached himself from the crime. He headed home, buying some fish and chips on the way.
Unbeknown to Strafford, a woman had passed by the Tumps and noticed him going into the field with this young girl, and this woman thought, for some reason, it didn't look right. When she got home, she told her husband what she'd seen. Her husband happened to be a policeman, and he then got a call, early morning call, to go and look for this little girl. So putting two and two together, they went to the field, and that's where they found Cicely under the hedge.
Strafford was arrested. In custody, he made muddled and childish statements, saying he'd left the little girl asleep, or he'd left her dead, but he hadn't killed her.
I don't think that Strafford has a concept of guilt. I think he's so educationally challenged that he has no concept of right or wrong. He doesn't have the moral development that would allow one to say he was conscious of guilt or indeed of innocence. He has no way of marrying up his behavior to the consequences of his behavior.
The police charged Strafford for the murder of Cicely Batstone. But unbeknown to them, he would then go on to confess to another killing, the murder of Brenda Goddard.
As far as I'm aware, the police never realised themselves that the two were connected. It was Strafford, in fact, who told them, "I did the other girl as well." And it seems that at the police station, he apprehended any passing officer and was prepared to confess to them, to both these two murders.
There was no direct evidence to link him to Brenda at that time. It was only through the Cicely murder and his own admission to the police that he had killed the other little girl. And this is what makes me believe that perhaps he was getting into the feeling of strangling, because he was so interested in explaining to the police officer how he murdered Brenda, to the extent that he offered to demonstrate how he stood behind and strangled her from behind and how he did it. And the police allowed him to demonstrate on one of their officers to show, and he went through the whole procedure about she didn't scream, which seemed to be a puzzle to him, that she went limp. All of the descriptions, almost as though it was some kind of experiment.
Strafford had no concept of the seriousness of the crimes he'd committed. He laughed it off, saying, "She's dead, but you can't prove I did it."
When it comes to trial, he is of diminished responsibility. And therefore, there are very different types of punishment for someone in Strafford's case, because he has diminished responsibility, from, say, a double murderer who would be able to accept responsibility for his actions.
On the 17th of October, 1951, at Taunton Assizes, John Strafford was charged with the murder of Cicely Batstone. He was found unfit to plead, with the judge telling the jury, "In this country, we do not try people who are insane. So insane as not to understand what is going on. You might as well try a baby in arms."
Strafford was sent to Broadmoor Hospital, but it didn't end there.
I'm Fred Dynage, and I'm retracing the shocking case of John Strafford, child killer and Britain's longest-serving prisoner.
At the age of 21, Strafford had brutally strangled 6-year-old Brenda Goddard and 9-year-old Cicely Batstone. His mental deficiencies had saved him from a high-security prison. But he was now faced with the infamous Broadmoor Hospital until His Majesty's pleasure be known.
What you've got to remember is Broadmoor is a hospital. It's classed as a hospital and not as a prison. And so it's more about trying to understand why people do things, putting what therapy or what drugs are needed to control people.
How would Strafford have been perceived in Broadmoor? What would they have thought about him?
It's really hard, because here you're talking about a man who's committed heinous crime. He's murdered two young girls. There was no sexual thing, so he's not classed as a deviant. He's classed as a very dangerous person to young girls. So they would be trying to work out his psychopathy, really. Why does he target these people? What can we learn from it? He would have been a client, a patient, but also a sort of psychological guinea pig. What makes you tick, mate, so we don't have that happen again?
With an IQ of 58, Strafford was recognised as being among the lowest 1% of the population for intelligence. But what does having a low IQ mean, and how does it affect you? Could it have influenced Strafford's decision-making process in the crimes he committed? Professor David Wilson has invited me to find out about the relevance of IQ.
Fred, as you know, one of the features of the Strafford story is IQ. We've got with us Professor Andrew Silk of the University of East London to answer some questions about IQ. Andrew, what is IQ?
IQ is a measure of intelligence, or at least that's what it's supposed to be.
What does it tell you, though, about a person?
It tells you something about a person's verbal skills and something about their spatial skills. So it is limited. It doesn't tell you everything about them. Someone can score very high in IQ but still struggle day to day, or someone that could score very low in an IQ but actually be very successful. We know that part of your IQ comes from inheritance. It's genetics, it's built in, but a big chunk is down to environment. It's down to your family, it's down to your upbringing, it's down to the type of school that you went to.
There was some indication that Strafford suffered from encephalitis, inflammation of the brain. How would that affect the test?
Absolutely. Encephalitis is associated with lower IQs in about 20% of cases, and it's basically because of the damage done to the brain as a result of the infection.
So, Andrew, can you give us some basic facts and figures? What's a normal IQ? What's high? What's low?
OK. The average IQ is 100. Plus or minus about 15 of 100 is still in the normal range. That's considered an average score. So anything between about 85 to 115 has you in the normal category.
Well, in fact, Strafford's IQ was measured at 58. In terms of the legal process, would that allow him to be regarded as mentally fit to plead?
Now, there's interesting problems there because the legal process does not have a set IQ. So they would look at the IQ, but they would also look at how the person is functioning. Currently in the UK prison system, it's estimated that about 7% of prisoners have an IQ below 70.
It would be interesting, would it not, to find out how you and I got on in an IQ test?
We should.
Are you game?
I am.
May the better man win. Famous IQ results include Stephen Hawking and Albert Einstein at 160, Moore's murderer Ian Brady at 170, artist Andy Warhol, 86, and Charles Manson, 109.
Andrew, I think it's the moment of truth. Might also be a career-ending moment for me. What are the test results?
Okay, remember, the average score is 100. So anything above 100 is above average. Test results, Fred, you scored 143.
I'm joking.
Oh, no!
What? You winding me up?
No, genuine score.
I feel
very high level. Anything above 130 counts as superior, or on some scales would count as genius level.
Oh, dear, Fred, what do you feel?
Can't believe it. What did he get?
Oh, no.
He got 155.
Wow, almost a genius.
Well, in some scales, it would be a genius. In some scales, both scores are genius level. They're in the top 2.5% of the population.
What's the relationship between IQ and crime?
Once upon a time, researchers thought that if you had a low IQ, that meant you were more likely to become involved in crime. And the reasons for that were, for example, you didn't have legitimate ways of making money, you were more likely to drop out of school, and you were also, frankly, more likely to be caught.
So would IQ be used to solve crime?
You could use IQ to a degree. So, for example, if we're dealing with serial killers, some serial killers have very high IQs. Harold Shipman, good example, 140, very, very smart man. But some have very low IQs. Fred West had an IQ of 74. So you're dealing with a very, very different type of an offender. And obviously the police, when it comes to crime scene examination, there will be indications of whether you're dealing with someone who's intelligent, has planned ahead, has prepared, is trying to cover up forensic evidence, as opposed to a crime scene which is very sloppy. It looks spontaneous, it doesn't look like it was premeditated, and that would suggest then that you're dealing with an offender with a lower IQ. You're not looking at someone who's very, very smart.
And for Strafford, his low IQ could be seen in his actions, in the spontaneous murders of two young girls, the lack of damage control after the killings, and his confession to the police. However, his mental deficiencies had kept him out of prison, and instead he was committed to a high-security hospital for treatment.
By April 1952, Strafford had been an inmate at Broadmoor for 6 months. He was sent to assist another patient, cleaning some outbuildings known as the surgery.
It was then that Strafford saw his chance.
He escaped by planning a route out. He had taken from wherever locker or room they keep civilian clothes, his civilian clothes, put them on under his Broadmoor work clothes, gone to a particular part of Broadmoor where he was designated to clean, and made an excuse to go out and shake his duster, and I believe another patient came out and said, have you finished dusting yet? And he said, no, I'll be with you in a minute. As soon as that other patient had gone in, he was up on a small shed on the roof, about 8 foot off the ground, got him onto the 15-foot wall over the top, brought more clothes off and away across the fields.
Once over the wall and changed, Strafford headed west through Crowthorne. He had no plan and no money. Only 11 men had escaped from Broadmoor Hospital since 1900. In 1952, Strafford had become the 12th.
We've got to remember the kind of period of time we're talking about. There was no siren that could be sounded. There was no way of contacting the local police station and alerting the police that there had been an escapee from Broadmoor.
Strafford had walked more than 7 miles, making several stops along the way before reaching Farley Hill. This escapee from Broadmoor appeared to be taking a leisurely stroll.
On the run would be an inappropriate term. He seemed to just stroll along in the sunshine, calling in at a couple of houses en route for cups of tea. And in fact, the first house he went into, he had an extraordinary conversation with the woman who said, what's it like living near Broadmoor? Do people escape from Broadmoor? And in other words, really opening himself up to her.
When Strafford reached the village store in Farley Hill, he was noticed by Mr. Sims and his stepdaughter, 5-year-old Linda Bowyer. Linda was riding her bicycle up and down the road. No one suspected anything, as the news of the escaped convict had not yet reached the village.
By about 10 to 6, Strafford had appeared at another house asking for a glass of water. In fact, he asked this lady, who happened to be the nanny, and she went to the owner of the house, who invited Strafford in for a pot of tea and biscuits. He was asking questions about, again, escaping from Broadmoor, the police, the 6 o'clock news, is there any kind of information? But in a very sort of roundabout way, I'm not sure it would have made sense to the person.
Strafford wanted to travel to Wokingham and asked directions to the nearest bus stop. Local resident, Mrs. Miles, offered the blonde stranger a lift. As the car approached the bus stop, Strafford spotted men in uniform.
Strafford recognises that there are two members of staff from Broadmoor at the bus stop, and so he makes away from the bus stop into one of the villages. But the woman who gives him the lift alerts the two members of staff, and this is how the police gradually close in on Strafford, who's only out of Broadmoor for some 4.5 hours.
That evening, the parents of 5-year-old Linda Bowyer, who'd been cycling up and down the road, reported her missing. With the knowledge of Strafford's escape, the police started the search immediately.
Well, at that point in time, nobody knew that there was any problem with Linda Bowyer. She was out cycling. There's no report at all of a missing child until around about 11 o'clock that night. Quite a late report to the police that, in fact, she hadn't returned home. And she was discovered early the next morning in a small copse under a tree.
Linda Bowyer had been strangled. Her body was found near a large oak tree just 30 yards from her abandoned bicycle. As in the murders of Brenda and Cicely, there was no sign of a struggle, no attempt to conceal the body. Strafford had been a free man for just 4 hours and 5 minutes. Had he exacted revenge for his incarceration, or was this just a terrible coincidence?
I'm Fred Dynage, and I'm investigating the series of events that made John Strafford Britain's longest-serving prisoner.
In October 1951, Strafford had been sent to Broadmoor for the murders of Brenda Goddard and Cicely Batstone. But just 6 months after, he'd escaped, only to be recaptured 4 hours later. 5-year-old Linda Bowyer had been strangled just 7 miles from Broadmoor Hospital, and the police knew exactly who to question. John Strafford was the prime suspect.
we have a very similar set of circumstances in terms of Linda Bowyer's death as we had for the other two murders. So there is some way of connecting Strafford up to Linda Bowyer. Now, crucially, she's 5 years old. So a younger girl, but still within the age group that Strafford concentrates on. And crucially, the MO's the same. She's strangled. There's no evidence of sexual assault, either pre or post-mortem. There's no attempt to hide the body. She is simply abandoned.
At 8 o'clock the next morning, the police visited Broadmoor to interview Strafford. The murder of Linda Bowyer had been kept quiet from the other patients, and the police hoped to entice the information out of the recent escapee.
His reply was memorable because he actually said, "I didn't kill the little girl." So they pointed out that they actually hadn't mentioned anything about a little girl, let alone killing a little girl. There's no mention of this. And this evoked the response, "I know what you policemen are like." He just anticipated that they'd come to ask him. He tried to sort of bluff his way through, I think. It was clearly something that he had already now started, which was going to lead to quite an interesting situation, because the next question, of course, was to say, well, actually, there was a little girl missing, but we didn't say she'd been killed. And then the most memorable part was when he said, "I didn't kill the little girl on the bicycle."
Strafford had unknowingly admitted his guilt to the police, giving them the crucial evidence they needed to charge him.
On the 21st of July 1952, John Strafford was charged with the murder of Linda Bowyer at the courthouse here in Winchester. During the trial, Strafford was detained at Brixton Prison. Broadmoor was no longer considered a secure option for the escapee.
Our attitudes towards crime and punishment changed after the Second World War. They became much harsher. The ease with which Strafford escapes from Broadmoor and the fact that he killed again meant that there was a controversy about what the regime at Broadmoor was like internally. And to this day, the fact that the siren sounds at Broadmoor on a Monday stems directly from Strafford's escape.
Strafford pleaded not guilty to the murder of the 5-year-old girl, but his offence was considered to be too awful to be defended with a plea of insanity. He was deemed by the court to be a sane man.
There were two main strands of the prosecution case. The first one was this supposed admissions to the police, where he said, "I didn't kill the little girl on the bicycle." The second fact is what we now call similar fact evidence. The prosecution sought to introduce the two previous murders on the grounds that they were the same as this third murder. Now, the law has been changed now, but in 1950, you weren't allowed to refer to previous convictions. So how was it that the prosecution managed on this solitary occasion to bring in the previous cases? And of course, the answer is they weren't convictions at all, because the matter hadn't actually gone to trial. He'd just been found unfit to stand trial. And so therefore, they weren't technically convictions, and therefore the prosecution were able to bring them in.
Strafford's mental ability evoked debate throughout the trial, but it wasn't the only controversy. The newspapers had picked up the case and it became the biggest crime story since the war.
It's often said, if it bleeds, it leads. And there was a photograph in one of the papers of the mother of Cicely Batstone, the mother of Brenda Goddard, and the mother of Linda Bowyer. Now, that has quite an emotional impact on the reading public, but it's significant because it also has quite a legal impact. It immediately creates an impression that Strafford was guilty of the first two murders. He therefore must be guilty of this third murder. And that makes finding a jury in his trial very difficult indeed, to the extent that the first jury that's identified has to actually be allowed to relinquish their duties, and a second jury has to be signed in instead.
And when it came to the summing up, what did the judge say? The judge said to the jury, "You should bear in mind that when something unusual has happened, and witnesses give times which may not always be accurate, So we have here the astonishing situation where the judge is inviting the jury to convict the defendant, not on the basis of the evidence that they've heard, but in spite of the evidence they've just heard.
The trial took 2 days, with the jury making their decision in just 29 minutes. John Strafford was found guilty and sentenced to hang.
Here's a man that's been identified as having diminished responsibility of being a mental defective under the terms of the Mental Health Act. So if he's mentally insane in one set of murders, how can he suddenly be sane for this new murder of Linda Bowyer? So the court has some problems in terms of how to manage that, but ultimately he is found guilty and he's sentenced to hang. That causes a further uproar because, of course, then the public say, well, wait a minute, you can't hang this man because he's mentally insane.
Empathy for the mentally challenged Strafford grew. Newspapers held opinion polls asking the public, should he be hanged? On the 29th of August 1952, Sir David Maxwell Fyfe, the then Home Secretary, reprieved Strafford. His sentence was converted to life in prison. Broadmoor was not an option. But there were still doubts over Strafford's conviction and discrepancies in the evidence.
In 1997, Strafford submitted an appeal to the Criminal Cases Review Commission. He'd never admitted to the murder of Linda Bowyer and was still adamant of his innocence. Strafford had now spent 45 years in prison and was now aged 67.
For those of us who think that the explanation of the third murder may have lain not with Strafford, but in the domestic circumstances of the child concerned, it was quite interesting that she was reported missing at 10:30 at night. And you've had an escaped child murderer from Broadmoor, and this girl has apparently gone missing at about 6:00. So why on earth are they waiting 4.5 hours to report her missing in those circumstances?
The discrepancies were heard and the case went to the Court of Appeals in 2002, but was denied. 72-year-old Strafford remained in prison.
In the prison system, there is a sort of hierarchy, isn't it? And child killers are very low down on the list. What about stranglers?
It's not so much as stranglers or whether you've done it with an axe. It's, the thing is children. Sex offenders are, in that world, the most lowest of low. You can't get no lower than that. With Strafford, he wasn't a molesterer. You know, really, if it had been anyone, they would have took him out. But because he was a child himself in a man's body, you know, and it was quite a big debate, you know, should we take him down or not? And someone said a very potent thing. They said, he's got the mental age of a child, a 10-year-old. If we'd done him, we're no different to what he's done, because we'd be doing a child.
You saw Strafford in prison. Mm. What was he like?
Well, it was a sad, pathetic little figure. You would see this wandering little man, and also, as I say, childlike, you know, behaviour. He'd be doing his little bit of sweeping up or whatever he's doing. In prison, you get three types of people. You get the sad, the mad, and the bad, OK? The bad, we deal with them. The sad, well, that's what they are. They're sad people, and you can think, the nightmare you're living with, we can't add to that. And then you get the insane ones, the mad. He was definitely one of the sad.
John Strafford admitted responsibility for the deaths of Brenda Goddard and Cicely Batstone, but always maintained he did not kill Linda Bowyer. Strafford spent the rest of his days in prison. He died at the age of 77 in Franklin Prison in Durham on the 19th of November 2007.
For the whole of the 55 years he's been in prison, he maintained he did not kill Linda Bowyer. And that's quite a strong mental discipline. And for me, that's the strongest bit of evidence, although it's not evidence. To actually always be indignant about that murder, it just seems odd. If he did in fact do it, why would he constantly maintain he didn't do it?
It's people like Strafford that make parents like you and me think very carefully about how we control what happens to our children during that period of existence called childhood. So, whilst I accept that we're dealing with a man who had challenged educational needs, this for me is somebody who had to be locked up for the rest of his natural life because there was no indication whatsoever that that kind of lack of moral reasoning that he had ever been improved. And I've no doubt that if he had been released, he would have killed again.
No one can deny that Strafford was a child killer who murdered his victims for nothing more than petty revenge. But whether he should have served his sentence in prison or a high-security hospital is a question that will always remain unanswered.